恭敬大德圣境，为此发挥及一切众生，请转妙法轮教。
Happy and honored to be here at the City of 10,000 Buddhas once again. I first visited here in 1990, the year before Dharma Master Heng Lu received his full acceptance as a bhikshu, and I have been visiting very regularly since then. I went back to live in England in 2010, so about 8 years ago, so my visits have been less frequent since that time, but I still feel a strong connection with this place, City of 10,000 Buddhas, and of course Abhayagiri Monastery just up the road in Redwood Valley. I was the abbot, co-abbot with Venerable Ajahn Pasano for many years, as the Dharma Master Heng Lu mentioned. Coming back at this time, now both myself and Venerable Ajahn Pasano have retired from being abbots of Abhayagiri, and it's now under new management. Ajahn Karunadamo, Ajahn Yaniko are now the new co-abbots of Abhayagiri Monastery. And so I've said many times in the last week, it fills me with great joy to see things being passed on to the next generation. And say the developments of the community there, seeing it thriving with many monks, novices, and members of the lay community, very say actively involved in working there, living there, supporting the place, and similarly coming here today to the City of 10,000 Buddhas to see that the community is say very abundant, many members of the monastic community, lay community gathered here today, and also was being shown around the Sudana Center, the new facility in Ukiah. And then also the new university buildings been refurbished and redeveloped here on the main campus of City of 10,000 Buddhas. And also the new wonderful Enlightenment Buddhist Institute. I think that's correct. Yes. being developed out in the eastern meadows of the property. That was a project that was being talked about more than 20 years ago. So it's very wonderful indeed to see that coming to fruition. At Abhayagiri itself, main meditation hall, a new Dhamma hall, has been completed with a new spectacular kitchen and many amenities for the resident community, the lay community there. And that was a project that again took quite a few years to design and to build, and then coming to see that all completed with a beautifully landscaped gardens and more accommodating facilities, a Dhamma hall that can take a few hundred people rather than just about 50 or 60 people is very wonderful to see. And when we reflect upon these kind of material developments, not just the physical structures, so the beautiful new university buildings here, or the beautiful reception facilities, the Dhamma Hall at Abhayagiri, we can focus on this, or seeing talking with Dharma Master Heng Lu, saying, oh, yes, it's a full house here. The place is we have about 19 or 20 monks, about 70 nuns, many, many lay people. The schools are full. The schools are waiting for the new buildings to be used so that the other buildings can be freed up so that the schools can expand. So we can see these as signs of success or abundance, things going really well, things as we would like. But one of the most common teachings of our own master, Venerable Ajahn Chah, that he would repeat very, very often, he would say, success and failure are of equal value. Liking and disliking are of equal value. Now, to our ordinary worldly way of thinking, we hear those words and we think, well, wait a minute, that's not right. Success is much better than failure. Yeah, getting what I like is good. Getting what I don't like is bad. But this is how the world works. This is the worldly way of thinking. And so what did he mean when he would say like and dislike are of equal value, or success and failure are of equal value? In using these words, he's speaking the language of Dharma. He's speaking the language of, the perspective of wisdom, of banya, prajna, to change the way that we look at our life. So all of us like success, you know, it's a full house, the place is energetic, people are enthusiastic, yes, we feel this is a good thing. But if the mind grasps that goodness, if we take hold of happiness or success, we take hold of the things that we like, then that very way that the mind takes hold of that success, that happiness, then that turns into its opposite by creating a sense of ownership or a sense of, of dependency, depending on that success, that praise, that happiness, getting what we like. Then in that very grasping of it, we create a fear that, oh, it's going to go away, or it's not going to be like this next year, or, oh, now we've got to hang on to this. So when we see things with the eye of Dhamma, when we see things with wisdom, then we see that succeeding and failing are of equal value, because and just as we like to succeed and we like to get things in the form that pleases us, when we experience what we dislike, our first feeling might be, oh no, it's really awful. I've got an illness, or nobody is showing up, or the program that we launched, nobody has signed up for it. We've got this beautiful new university and no students have applied. Yeah. All these beautiful new buildings and they're empty. You know, we might think of this as failure. and bad and wrong, what we don't want. But if we are wise, then we'll recognize the quality of failure, of getting what we don't like. This is an experience that arises in the moment, that we think, oh, this is exactly what I didn't want. This is a bitter taste. This is a flavor that is not likable, but the mind doesn't have to create suffering around that. So we don't have to grasp dislike or failure or being with the uncomfortable. So this is a very simple teaching, but a very powerful and very liberating one. Now, when I talk about this, I often invite people to say, carry out a little exercise. So think of something that, say, 5 or 10 years ago was a big success for you. You were really happy about. You got accepted as a bhikshu or as a bhikshuni. You got, taken on as a professor at the university. You got a pay rise. You got appointed to a new position. You got your book published. You finally got the house paid off. And you thought, great, fantastic. So some event, I invite all of us to think back maybe 5 or 10 years to some event in our lives where we thought, great, that's exactly what I wanted. And then to think of that same event 5 or 10 years later, you think, oh, how could I have been so happy? Why was I celebrating? When I got that new house, little did I realize how difficult the neighbors were going to be. Or when I got my book published, I was so happy to get my book published, and suddenly all my friends hate me because my book is successful and they feel jealous. Oh, I didn't see that coming. Or finally, I finally got to enter into the bhikshu life. At last, I'm a bhikshu. Oh no, now I've got to keep all these rules. Oh dear. So these are ways that we can look back and say, look at some event in our life we were so happy about. This is exactly what I wanted. But then when we look at it from a distance, oh, how could I have been celebrating? In the same way, look back 5 or 10 years to some event in your life that was really a problem. You got really ill, you had some big conflict, you were fighting with someone. You lost all your money, you got thrown out of the monastery, everyone decides you're a terrible person and they all hate you. And we look back at that, and at the time you think, this is awful, this is a disaster, the building has fallen down, it was my design, and we wasted a huge amount of money and it was my fault. And then 5 or 10 years later, you look back and you realize, oh, well, I hated it at the time, but actually, that was the best thing that ever happened to me. Any of you ever had that kind of experience? I see a few people smiling, nodding their heads. I'm not being psychic. This is not psychic power. This is just statistics. This is how we are as human beings. So I feel this is a very useful little exercise to perform. So when we look at that, what does that say about gain and loss, about success and failure, about liking and disliking? What that means is that when we get what we like, and we think, yes, this is exactly what I wanted. Hooray, at last we're getting that building constructed. Yes. Then to think, well, wait a minute. Maybe this is not the whole story. Maybe I should not grasp this as something intrinsically, automatically good. Maybe I should just know, this is the flavor of sweetness. This is the beautiful flavor of getting what you want. It's just a flavor. And when things go badly and your project fails and people dislike you or criticize you, things are what you don't want, then to, in the same way, look at that and consider, okay, this is bitterness. This is a bitter taste. So what can be learned from this? This is the feeling of getting what you don't want. This is bitter. Okay, what can be learned from this? So Venerable Ajahn Chah, he would always emphasize, it's not whether we like it or we dislike it, but what can we learn from it? That's the important principle. That's the essential principle. Rather than getting what we like or we dislike, whether we succeed or we fail, then What can we learn from this? In our lives in the monastery, monastic training, then we all do our best. We are sincere. We try hard to purify our hearts of greed, hatred, and delusion. Whether you're from the northern tradition or the southern tradition, all of us are working in the same way to do the best we can to live in a skillful way, to recognize our habits that are unwholesome or unskillful, and to change them, to live in a more beneficial way, a way that brings peacefulness and happiness to ourselves and to other people. But we all make mistakes. Again, this is not to do with north or south. We all make mistakes. We say things that are unkind or are not really completely true. Or we act in ways that are cruel or selfish. We act in ways that are aggressive or unkind. Again, I'm not reading anybody's mind. I don't have CCTV cameras on all of your residences. But this is how we are as human beings. We make mistakes. But one of the aspects of training that the Buddha established, and I feel is very beneficial both for the monastic community and the lay community, is that the Buddha did not expect us to never make mistakes. Rather, he understood this is why we train ourselves, because we're not perfectly enlightened. We're not completely free of greed, hatred, and delusion. So, say we just finished the rains retreat in our own calendar for the southern Buddhist world. The rainy season retreat finished on the full moon of October. And on that day, we have a special ceremony. It's called the invitation, the Pavarana ceremony. And I think this is applicable to us whether we're northern or southern, or whether we're layperson or monastic. And this is a practice, a ceremony that the Buddha established, whereby we invite our friends, our companions in the holy life, whether our fellow monastics or in the lay community. You can invite your family, your friends, and you say, whatever I have done during this last period of time that has, say, been upsetting or been difficult, or that you feel it would be good for me to know about, please tell me. I invite you. So Pavarana means invitation. Please give me feedback. Now, this is something that I talk about a lot every year around this time. But I feel it's a very useful principle. The Buddha once said, if somebody offered you a pile of gold, say that worth like $100 million, a huge pile of gold, or they would offer you feedback about your conduct, he said, if you're wise, you would prefer to receive the feedback rather than the huge pile of gold. The feedback about your conduct, criticism about your conduct from your friends, is more valuable than $100 million or $500 million. And again, from our worldly sense, what would you rather have? People saying, well, I don't like your speech, and you know, you're really kind of selfish, and you know, I don't like your food, you know, that the way that you dress is kind of inappropriate, you know, that your speech is very kind of aggressive or unkind. We don't want to hear that, do we? None of us like to hear the kind of our faults or our actions, our speech being criticized. On a worldly level, we don't like that. So if we're asked, do you want to be criticized, or would you like a pile of gold for worth $100 million, $500 million? I'll take the gold, you know. The worldly mind says, give me the gold. But the Buddha, who is very good at coming up with these powerful images, these ways to catch our attention, said, it's more valuable to be pointed out, yeah, that your speech is not very kind, or that the way you dress is not very tidy. You know, the way that you say carry out your teachings, or the way that you work is something that there's something about that that is careless or wasteful or foolish. So when we're told that our behavior is upsetting or could be better, our ego, that's what we call a self-view, is pained. Oh, don't say that. But the Buddha said, this is very valuable to us, because if our friends don't tell us where we can improve ourselves, then it's unlikely that we'll see it for ourselves. So we improve ourselves through receiving feedback from our friends. Another part of that same ceremony is what we call asking for forgiveness. So, again, recognizing that we make mistakes. Even with the best of intentions, we annoy each other. You know, by the way, maybe we chant too fast or too slow, or too loud or too quietly. Maybe when we have the circumambulation, we go too fast or too slow. Or maybe we're doing it so perfectly that it's really annoying to the other people. This last year, when we had a big Sangha meeting at Amravati, all of the branch monasteries, the heads of the branch monasteries from around the world gathered together at Amravati. I was the host because it was a big community gathering, and I'm the abbot. And when it came up for looking for or the opportunity to bring criticism or to express displeasure, I was criticized for being too punctual. Ajahn, you're always on time. It's really intimidating. You're never late. It's upsetting. So I'm kind of proud of being criticized for being too punctual, but so I confess to that. But for some people, that was painful to them. Ugh, he's so annoyingly punctual. He's always on time. It makes me look bad. So we annoy each other. We upset each other, and often unconsciously. So we ask for forgiveness. We say, for whatever I have done, by body, speech, or mind, intentionally or unintentionally, that has been upsetting or painful to you, I ask for your forgiveness. And then the other person says, I forgive you, please forgive me also. So again, whether you're in the monastery or whether you're in a household with your people that you work with, I feel this is a very beautiful and wholesome tradition, a custom to cultivate, to say help guide our lives with. Now, when we are not ready to, say, call upon our friends, our Kalyanamitta, and ask for this kind of help or kind of feedback, then we might feel that we are okay. I don't need feedback. I'm kind of in control of my life. I know what I'm doing. I feel happy about my actions, and you know, I do things the way I do, and I feel I'm a pretty good person. But and that is an understandable feeling, but I feel it's very helpful to recognize that even if we're not aware of it, we do make mistakes. We're not reliable. Our memories are not reliable. Our opinions are not absolute facts. They are our point of view. Sometimes we're not very well informed. Sometimes we don't remember things very clearly. And even when we're sure that we do, perhaps we don't. So I often tell the story of how in 1983, I made a long walk. I was inspired by the students of Shurfu, Master Xuanhua's early Western disciples, Hung Ju and Hung Yo, who did a three steps, one bow pilgrimage from San Francisco up to Marble Mount in Washington, I believe. I read the story and I thought, oh yeah, I'd like to go on a long walk through England. I didn't do three steps, one bow, but I walked all the way through England in a very windy route, about 830 miles from the south of England in Chithurst Monastery to the little branch monastery in the north of England near the Scottish border. So that took about 3 months, and that was in 1983. So that's 35 years ago. So 25 years after that, in 2008, the layman that I walked with, he and I decided to revisit some of the places, to retrace some of the steps of that walk. It was a wonderful adventure and a kind of unique opportunity for me as a young monk in 1983. So we thought we'd go back and visit some of the places and some of the people that we met along the way and see, you know, what were the changes in people's lives, who had died, who had married, who had given birth, you know, who had become monastics, who had gone into the monastery or left the monastery. And one of the most powerful experiences of that second walk was how all the things that I remembered, all the places that I visited the second time around, every single one of them had been changed. Now, what I mean by that is, so, say, for example, on that first walk in 1983, we went to visit this church on the top of a hill called St. Martha's Church. And I had this clear memory of standing in the doorway of the church and looking towards the hills to the south. When we got to the church the second time, 25 years later, the whole thing had been moved through 90 degrees. The door of the church didn't face to the south, it faced to the east. So, oh, that's not right. It was facing that way last time. I thought, how strange. Well, of course they didn't change the church because it's like 500 years old. But I had this clear memory that, oh, that's really weird. Because I remember standing in the door looking at the hills to the south. So, okay, fair enough. So we walk on. And then a few days later, we come to this village and to receive this invitation to the house of a layperson. We went to see her place the last time in 1983. She invited us back. I had this clear memory, the big house, it's right by the village green, and there's a driveway that goes up from the village green, and there's the house on the top of the little hill. We get to the village green, no driveway. Oh. Where have they put the house? What's happened? And then we look at the map. Oh, it says here it's half a mile outside the village. Oh, it can't be right. I remember. Right off the village green, there's the driveway and there's the house. But then we walk down the road half a mile. Oh, look, there's the driveway. They moved the whole house. And I won't bore you with the details, but it was amazing. Every single place that we revisited had been changed. There was this huge copper beech tree when we were in the visiting this village in Yorkshire. And it used to be right in front of the post office. And this 300-year-old tree had been moved to the other side of the street. Oh, it wasn't there before. I remember. There was the tree and there was the post office. No, the tree's over there. So I have a reputation for having a good memory. And so that was a really interesting teaching, because there was this message over and over again that memory is unreliable. What you think is a fact might not be a fact. What you're so sure that you're right about, and this isn't an opinion, it's a fact. So that was a powerful teaching of, well, even with what you think of as a clear memory, you could be wrong. So in terms of our hearts being freed of greed, hatred, and delusion, being helped to recognize where we make mistakes, where we get things wrong, it's very helpful to consider what I think is a fact might not be a fact. And that this is just my memory or my opinion. This is just one point of view. And then when we have that change of perception about our perspective, our experience, then we are much more flexible. We are much more adaptable in our heart. We're able to recognize, oh, I didn't get that right. Thank you very much for pointing that out to me. Oh, I could have done that better. Thank you very much. Oh, I didn't have the whole picture. Thank you very much. So what this points to is the importance of good friends. And again, this does not confine itself to Southern tradition or a northern tradition, or even just to Buddhism. You know, this is part of our human, our human experience. The value of good friends. And one of the teachings that I've been reflecting on a lot in the last year or so is where the Buddha speaks about the basis for ignorance. So what is the primary cause for us getting lost, for making mistakes, for creating difficulty for ourselves and others? And what he says is it's the absence of good friends. He said, if you have good friends, sapurisa, if you spend time with good people, then if you spend time with good people, that means it gives you more opportunities to listen to good teachings, to the sadhamma savana, to listening to the true dhamma. If you listen to good teachings, to the true dhamma, this will increase the quality of faith, sadha. So faith increases. If faith increases, this supports the quality of wise reflection. When faith in the Dhamma, in the Triple Gem arises, then this, helps the mind to be more reflective, to consider, to use more wisdom. When there is a greater quality of wise reflection, then we have more mindfulness and clear comprehension, sati sampajanya. Then you're more attentive, you're more attuned to the time, the place, the situation. If you have greater mindfulness and clear comprehension, then you are more restrained. You don't get pulled by impulses of like and dislike, fearing and wanting and hating. That the impulses of the heart are not followed automatically. You don't react to life, but you instead respond to it. So this is called indriya sangvara in the Pali, the restraint of the senses, so that there's a natural collectedness or containment. You're not kind of spread out or distracted or impulsive, as the good word to use in English to describe that. We're not so impulsive. When we are not impulsive, when there's restraint, then that, reduces the causes for greed, hatred, and delusion. The three unwholesome roots are deprived of their fuel. When greed, hatred, and delusion are weaker, then that also weakens what we call the five hindrances: sense desire, ill will, restlessness, dullness, and doubt. And when the five hindrances are weakened, when they lose their strength, that also takes away the fuel from avijja, from ignorance. So that's a lot to remember. But if we see that right at the very root is your friends, who do you choose to spend your time with? Yeah, who do you make the choice to be with? How do you spend your time? What do you put your attention onto? And the Buddha points out this makes a huge difference. If you don't spend time with good people, then the opposite things all happen. So you don't hear the good teachings, faith doesn't arise, you don't have the quality of wise reflection, there's less mindfulness and clear comprehension, less restraint of the senses, you're more reactive and impulsive, the greed, hatred, and delusion increase, the five hindrances increase, and ignorance increases. And the more there is ignorance, the more there is not seeing clearly, then the more we live in a state of stress and burden in life. The last thing I thought I'd share with you this evening also is to say that as I began with at the beginning, I feel very, very happy to see things developing so well, to see Abhayagiri's leadership passed on to the next generation, but also just to make mention of the fact that Abhayagiri Monastery exists where it does because of the great generosity of Master Xuanhua. It was Shifu's gift from his, literally from his deathbed, when he was reaching the last weeks and days of his life. He made the offering on behalf of the Dharma Realm Buddhist Association of 120 acres of land that forms half of the, or a section of the property at Abhayagiri. And that was offered to Ajahn Sumedho just before Shurafu passed away. And this is why Abhayagiri Monastery is there, just up the road in Redwood Valley. And so I feel very, very happy indeed to see that both City of 10,000 Buddhas is flourishing and doing so well, both in terms of the living community and the physical structures. Also seeing that Abhayagiri Monastery, say, having received that wonderful gift from Shurafu 23 years ago, that was in June of, end of May 1995, when he made that offering, that how wonderful it is to see that the offering has borne fruit and continues to bear fruit with the community that are resident there, lay community, monastic community, that are resident there and help to support the place. So I feel a great joy in that. But it's also, I say, even though we have these signs of, say, development and flourishing, we have both here, City of 10,000 Buddhas and Abhayagiri Monastery. I would again go back to saying that even though these are signs of success and flourishing, I would encourage us all not to grasp those qualities of blessing and success, getting what we want, because that very grasping, that saying, yes, this is great, everything's going really well, to say, well, this is the sweet taste of success. This is what it's like when things go well. What can we learn from this? So we are in following the Buddha's way, we appreciate the blessings and the opportunities that come to us, but they are most fully, actualized by the attitude of non-grasping, so that then with those blessings, those fortunate situations are received and made full use of, but they are most helpful to everybody if they are received and accepted and used without grasping, without the attitude of self-benefit or ownership. Then they can really flourish and be of benefit to all the individuals who live here and who pass through these doors. So I'll offer these thoughts for consideration, and I'm happy to open things up for time for questions and dialogue for the next 40 minutes or so. Ewang. Please don't be shy. There's a hand back there. I don't know if there's a microphone. There was a hand there, the woman with the maroon jumper.
Thank you, Ajahn Amaro. I have a question that you talked about inviting feedbacks, and do you have recommendations for how to accept or take in those feedbacks, because we also talk about things can be facts or can be people's opinions. Mm-hmm. So basically, yeah, do you have any suggestions or recommendations on how to take in those feedbacks and improve, or maybe sometimes ignore some of the feedbacks?
Well, it's a good question. Because in the Buddha's teachings, at least within the Pali Canon, the southern collection of teachings, he spells out a few different criteria, particularly about how to give feedback. So that there is five particular conditions. Firstly, if you want to give feedback to somebody, you say that you feel that their speech is really unkind, or that their the way that they are acting is sort of destructive or harmful in some way. So the five conditions are, firstly, you have to establish an attitude of loving kindness. So if I want you to be different because I'm annoyed with you, then and that might the motivation is my aversion, my negativity, then I should wait. That waiting can take a long time. And so when speaking about this, I've mentioned that I, in one particular instance, I waited for 2 years because there was that, I was feeling annoyed about the behavior of a particular monk, but I could see that, yeah, I wanted to say something, but it was just my negativity. So I waited until it was for him, not for me. Because if I want you to be different so I'll feel happy, then that's only part of the picture. And it also is an unskillful motivation. If I want you to be different so that you will be happy, so that you will stop causing yourself and others harm, then that's the right motivation to speak. So you establish an attitude of loving kindness in the heart. So that's the first thing. Secondly, you ask permission to bring up the subject. So if this happens within our community, you say, I'd like to raise something with you. Would that be okay? And if they say no, then okay. They have to give permission for you to raise the subject. So you ask permission. The third condition is choosing the right time and situation. So that in the middle of the assembly in the 10,000 Buddha Hall is not the place. Yeah, you choose a situation, say, where the person won't be embarrassed, or you've got plenty of time to talk. You're not just sort of sitting on a bus together, and you're about to get off at the bus stop, and so you've only got 1.5 minutes to talk. Yeah, you choose a time and a place that is discreet, where you've got plenty of time, where there is the opportunity to speak freely. The fourth condition is that you should stick to the facts rather than hearsay. So rather than, I heard that you were really unkind when you spoke to that other person in the office the other day, that I was told that you said such and such. Rather than going by hearsay, you go according to what you know to be true to the best of your ability. So, or rather than assumptions about what someone was thinking or what someone was feeling. So say for an example might be that, you know, when we met in the doorway, yeah, you took one look at me and you kind of scowled and you were really angry with me. And I was just upset by that and it made me feel uncomfortable all day. And then you're making the assumption when that person made that face at you that they were angry. Then the other person says, oh, I wasn't angry. I was just trying to get to the bathroom. And yeah, you were in my way, but it was nothing to do with you. I just had a bathroom emergency. So, but you know, you can assume that, oh, that person gave me that nasty look because they were angry with me. But that was just your assumption. So that fourth condition is to not make assumptions, but to speak according to what is factual as far as you can. And then the fifth one, this is the kind of the most challenging one, is you have to be free of the same fault yourself. Yes, so that can be a challenging one. So if you want to criticize someone for being angry and reactive, if you recognize that you've still got that problem yourself, then it's more skillful to deal with that in yourself before you bring that up with another. Like in one of Master Xuanhua's well-known verses, he said, "You know, truly recognize your own faults. Do not criticize the faults of others, and others' faults are just your own. Being one with everyone is called the great compassion," if I remember that correctly. So that at least being ready to recognize your own faults. And sometimes people have brought this, when I've talked about this, people say, can we negotiate number five, Ajahn? Can we kind of acknowledge that, you know, I've still got work to do there, but bring up the subject anyway? Now, these are guidelines. These are not absolute. And sort of, it's not a diktat. You know, these are guidelines to, say, give us, say, skillful structures for offering feedback. So if you're receiving the feedback, then if someone says, can I bring something up with you? And your first reaction is no, then that's something to look at. Why are you afraid of what someone might say to you? That they are offering you a treasure more valuable than a pile of gold. Are you sure that what they're going to say is not going to be helpful or not going to be true or not valuable? Or is this just a kind of fearful reaction in your heart? So that when you are approached by someone, or say they'd like to bring something up with you, to examine, to look at your own heart and say, well, part of me doesn't want to hear that, doesn't want to hear this, but part of me recognizes, yeah, I think this would be useful. Rather like going to the dentist. Yeah, that tooth does feel a bit weird, but I don't need to go to the dentist. I'm fine. But part of you recognizes, actually, it would be good to get a checkup. So having that sense of honesty, being, ready to look at your own reactions, your own aversion to being told something that might not be pleasant. That's the key thing, and also being ready to say, well, yes, I'm open to hearing what you got to say, but can we make it next week? Can we leave it? And which I feel is also quite appropriate, because you know, that again, going back to that condition of the right time, the right place, the right situation, that just to say, yes, can we talk tomorrow, or can we talk next week? And then you're able to ready yourself, to make yourself a bit more open and prepared to, you know, receive what they might want to say. And it might be that actually what they say is far less intimidating and difficult than you're afraid of. Does that answer your question? So please, yes, another hand at the back there.
Thank you, Ajahn Amaro. My question is, as a lay person, what's a healthy approach to contemplating death?
Whether you're a lay person or a monastic, I think we're all in the same boat, you know. whether you have hair or no hair, you know, we all stop breathing one day. It's interesting that the Buddha didn't, at least in the Pali canon, the Buddha doesn't really distinguish between giving advice to lay people or monastics in terms of contemplations of death. One of the most helpful teachings, I believe you find it both in the Sutra of 42 sections and also the Pali canon as well, is where the Buddha asks the assembly, how long is a human lifespan? And someone says, Venerable Sir, 70 years. And he said, you don't understand my teaching. Then 60 years, 50 years, 40 years, you don't understand my teaching. 30, 20, 10 years, you don't understand my teaching. 5 years, 4 years, 3 years, 2 years, you don't understand my teaching. So no, as a human being, no one can expect to live more than, say, 6 months. Buddha said, you don't understand my teaching either. Yeah, 1 month, half a month. 1 week, you don't understand my teaching. 1 day, And someone says, we can't even expect to live a whole day. I say, half a day is the most we can reasonably expect to live. Again, the Buddha says, you don't understand my teaching. Finally, someone says, the only amount of time that we can reasonably expect to live is from the beginning to the end of an in-breath, or the beginning to the end of an out-breath, or the time it takes to swallow some food that you have already chewed. The Buddha said, you understand my teaching. So if you time it, that's about 3 or 4 seconds. So that's the amount of time that we can all reasonably expect to live. And even medically, you know, if you have an aneurysm, a blood vessel bursts in your brain, you have about that amount of time. Just a few seconds before everything comes to an end. So that that kind of contemplation, it might seem a bit intimidating, but I feel that having that kind of recollection is useful to us, whether we're a layperson or a monastic. You know, just last year they had these huge fires coming through the area up in Redwood Valley, and the forest at Abhayagiri is kind of scorched around the edges, and the fire came into the monastery, just didn't damage any of the buildings. So if we say we've only got a few seconds to live, you think, well, things don't really happen that way, or that's so rare, it's so unusual. But anyone who was around the fires last year, I think they would recognize that's not unreasonable. I wasn't here. I was in soggy England. You know, everything is kind of green and wet, but here everything is bone dry and very, very burnable. And the stories from the people in this area were really, really shocking. And this really having a very, very short period of time to get out of the house, and quite a few people died. Just in Redwood Valley, 8 people died from the fires. So that if we reflect upon that our life is extremely fragile, you know, today could be our last day, this breath could be our last breath, what do you want to be hanging on to? If you're worried about the paper you've got to hand in for your college course next week, yes, I have to, but if I'm going to be dead in the next few seconds, what does it really matter? So that's not to make us lazy or... like, oh, I've got this huge debt, you know, I've got to pay off my mortgage. Well, if I drop dead in the next 3 seconds. So it's not to be lazy or kind of evading our responsibilities, but really to keep everything in a context. And so that if you are, say, worried about something or hoping for something, you're excited about, oh, next week I'm going to. Then that reflection helps us to recognize, well, I have a plan to go on holiday next week. What will happen? It's not a sure thing. I know I have a plan, but what will happen is not sure. And so when we relate to things in that way, then again, like with attachment to success and failure, like and dislike, it balances everything out. So that you're not tying your mind to an imagined future, but rather you're bringing your attention to the present. The mind has a way of ignoring the fact of death. We have along with the memory, we have a forgettery that switches it off, because it's not news that every single one of these bodies here in the 10,000 Buddha Hall will stop breathing one day. Every single one. Nobody here is going to live forever. These bodies will all die. Now, when we hear those words, something in us goes, no! That somehow something in us feels it's negotiable, or that can't be true, but it only takes a few moments of contemplation to recognize, well, of course, how could it not be that way? But yet, when we come into this hall, we don't think, oh, we're all going to die one day. We think, oh, it's the Dhamma assembly on a Monday evening, Ajahn Amaro is giving a Dhamma talk. we forget that fact. So that the Buddha's encouragement to recollect, you know, the fact of death, also that we're of the nature to age, we are of the nature to sicken, and that all that we love will become separated from us. You know, as he said, all that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will become separated from me. That is threatening to the ego, to self-view. But when it's recollected, then there's a quality of freedom. You're not hoping for that which can't be. You're not looking for security in that which is intrinsically insecure. You're not looking for certainty in that which is uncertain. So in that letting go of looking for a future or a plan that you're sure of, the heart is actually relieved. There's a sense of relaxation and freedom. So it's simultaneously threatening to the ego, but freeing to the heart. Does that make sense? So, whether you're a layperson or a monastic, it applies in exactly the same way. You know, as a sort of professional renunciate, we shave our hair and give away all our possessions and have no money. But still, there's a lot of things we can hang on to. You know, our role as a senior monastic, or our ideas, our plans, our family, our memory, our monastery. You know, if the abbot of the monastery, you can have a lot of ownership. So, even if what you kind of possess is not material, you can still be hanging on to a lot of things. When Abhayagiri Monastery opened up in June of 1996, I was the new abbot. I'd been looking forward to this project happening for 5 or 6 years, and it was all, yes, at last we're going, this is great, and we've got this wonderful place. And at that time we had 250 acres of forest and a little bungalow, a little house and a few outbuildings. And so there's a lot of potential, but a huge amount of work to do. But I was eager, I was 39 years old, eager to sort of jump in and get going with this project. And then about 3 or 4 months after the monastery opened, then Ajahn Karunadhamma, who's a nurse by profession, noticed there was this mole, this kind of dark mole on my shoulder, and said, "That doesn't look very good, Ajahn. Have you had a dermatologist take a look at that?" And I said, "Yeah, 2 different doctors in England looked at it and they said, don't worry about it." And he said, "I don't know." Don't mind me quoting you, Ajahn. And then another of the members of the board, layman who is a doctor, said the same thing. "I don't like the look of that, Ajahn." So I went to go and see, I think, Dr. McClintock in Ukiah. And I walked into his surgery and he said, all right, what is it? Was not very enthusiastic to see me. But then I kind of showed this mole on my shoulder and he said, "Lie down." Got out his syringe, gave me some anesthetic, and reached for the scalpel right there. Literally, that's not an exaggeration. So that got sent off to the lab, and I had a very interesting week between when the mole got sent to the lab and I got the diagnosis back. Because the dermatologist, Dr. McClintock, said, "Well, that really looks like melanoma to me, but it's hard to tell how advanced it might be." And the year before, one of our students in San Francisco had also been diagnosed with melanoma, and she was told incorrectly that she was going to be dead by Christmas. That, you know, she was misdiagnosed, that it had recurred. So the previous year, I'd spent a lot of time counseling her with the fact that she's got, you know, 4 or 5 months left to live. And then, next thing, maybe you've got the same thing, or maybe not. So that was a really interesting week. But I've got this new monastery, and I'm the abbot, and maybe I'm going to be dead by Christmas. So that was a wonderful teaching, because in that week there was a kind of revelation of my list of all the things I thought I was in the middle of. This new monastery, this project, and well, Ajahn Pasno is supposed to come in a few months. Maybe he'll be the abbot and I'll be the ex-abbot, the late abbot. Yeah, who knows? He's older than I am, but if our friend in San Francisco has anything to go by, maybe that's my melanoma is advanced and I'm not going to make it. As it turned out, it was melanoma, but it was only the first stage, and they said, as long as you don't let the sun touch your skin, you'll be fine. So that's why people see me wearing a hat, and I keep out of the sun, and I've tried to follow the doctor's orders since then. But I mention it because it was a very powerful week, because it revealed all the things that I thought I was in the middle of, and then it said, well, actually, maybe you're not in the middle, maybe you're at the end of that book I was going to write, or the kutis, the huts we're going to build in the forest, it revealed what are the things that are really important, and the things that my mind was worrying about, or was interested in, or was excited about. So much of it just fell away, and what really mattered was the mind, and the mind's spiritual maturity or lack of spiritual maturity. The sense of what I was grateful for, the kind of wonderful teachers that I had the chance to be with, and the support from the Sangha of great spiritual companions, the amount of work left to do of the greed, hatred, and delusion that I was still carrying around in the heart. Like, poof, if I've only got 3 months to go, I better get to work. And so that was, and then the things that had seemed to be important, so many of them just fell away. So that was a really helpful introduction to beginning a project with your name written on it. And I found that that really kept things in perspective. Yes, I'm the abbot, but, you know, that's only a convention. That's a fragile thing, just like the fires coming over the hill. Yes, we've got a monastery, or maybe not. Like for the last year, the Abhayagiri community all came here at the invitation of Dharma Master Heng Lu, and they had to evacuate at like 2 a.m. from Abhayagiri. And Dharma Master Heng Lu kind of invited the whole community to come and stay here, so that the lay people and the monastics all moved into the City of 10,000 Buddhas for a week. And they didn't know whether there was a monastery there or not. There wasn't any news. So that was a very interesting week. This wonderful building, the new Dhamma Hall, and the fantastic kitchen. Well, maybe it's not there anymore. Maybe the fires are swept through and it's all gone. They didn't know. Even we heard that one of the people from Cal Fire had, at a certain point, suggested we should light a backfire and just torch this whole valley, so we'll stop the main fire from coming this way. Till somebody on the team said, well, actually, there's a few buildings here. If you light a backfire, then all of this is going to be lost. And so the recognition that maybe we've got a monastery, maybe we haven't. That might seem, oh, well, that's not my problem. But when we bring that home to our own life, we think, well, I've got a job. I've got a house. I've got a car. Maybe you haven't. Yeah, I don't know. You know, but then that recognition of fragility, of what they call the anicca sanya, the perception of impermanence, if we bring that to mind and say, well, I know I parked my car out there, maybe it's there, maybe it's not. I left my house earlier today, maybe it's there, maybe it's not. Right now, maybe a Abhayagiri has burnt down again. I really hope not. We would probably have heard, a few phones would have gone off to tell us. But maybe it has. So that active recollection and using our imagination to say, well, maybe it's that way. Don't know. So you're consciously inviting that perception of uncertainty into the heart. And then there's a kind of shudder of the ego. Like, don't say that. Oh, no. But that's mine. And that to receive that kind of shuddering, that kind of a paining in the heart, and say, yeah, that's the feeling of self-concern, of self-obsession, self-view. That's what it's like. And then there can be a letting go of that. And then that quality of ease in the heart that comes from, say, recognizing, well, of course it's uncertain. How could it not be? And in that moment, the heart is taking refuge in wisdom rather than in an imagined future or your imagined possessions or your continuation of your life. That you're not, your peace is not depending on your life continuing, but rather that is dependent on the triple gem. Any other questions? Maybe from this side. Yeah. Yeah, there's one here. Oh, okay.
Thank you, Venerable Ajahn. I have a question about undertaking projects. And for example, let's say finding a monastery, or you were talking about like a university, and we usually kind of set out a goal, and usually there's a goal, we envision success in it, like doing a, but then, so how do we not get attached to the results, but still be motivated to do a good job? I think for myself, that's kind of like the dilemma or the challenge I find myself in. I was wondering if you could speak to that. Thank you.
Yeah, a very, very good question. Oftentimes it's mistakenly represented that the Buddha said every kind of desire is problematic. And he did indeed say that desire is the cause of suffering, of dukkha. But that kind of desire is called tanha in Pali, or trishna in Sanskrit. But that's not the only kind of desire. So the other kind of desire, which can be very wholesome, is called chanda. And there's a set of four qualities that the Buddha spoke about that are necessary conditions to succeed at anything. So the Buddha's path is a path of effort. It's a goal-directed path. So it's not as though by following the Buddha's way, it's not a way going nowhere. You know, it's a way that's headed towards realization, is headed towards truth. It has a direction. So these four qualities that the Buddha talked about in terms of his own spiritual training, but also it applies to running a business or establishing a university or your meditation practice or anything, whether it's wholesome, unwholesome, or neutral. So these four, the first one is chanda, which means interest or desire, zeal, enthusiasm, that sense of, yeah, I want to do this, or this is interesting, or that has a value. So chanda is the first of these conditions. The second one is virya, which means energy. So you have to be interested, then you have to apply energy or effort to do it. The third one is citta, which in this respect means thinking about what it is that you want to do. So those three all work together. So chanda, virya, and citta. So that means you're interested to start a university, you're interested to launch a business, you put energy into it, and you think about how it's going to work. Okay, you need those three to function together. And then the fourth one is called vimansa, and that means reviewing. So did it work? You're interested to start a university, you put energy into it, you thought about the way to do it. Did it actually happen? Or did it not? What was the result? So all of those, chanda, virya, citta, and vimansa, they can all be developed completely free of self-view. So we can make effort and give direction, guided completely by mindfulness and wisdom, by satipanya. So self-view doesn't have to be involved at all. And that, in a way, the essence of skillful action is not the amount of energy we put into it, but rather whether it's free of self-view or not. Because as long as it's my project, I want to succeed, I've got to get this right, I'm going to show them, or this is a great thing and I'm going to get so much out of it, then all that I will produce a lot of suffering. And whether it succeeds or whether it fails. Like if it goes well, it's like, look at me, I'm so successful, look at my place, look at my business, look at my monastery, aren't you amazed? You know, that's the kind of, even if it's successful, you turn it into a monster through that kind of self-obsession and self-cherishing. And then if it fails, it's like, oh no, what do they think of me? That was so stupid. Everyone knows I'm an idiot. I made such a mistake. I lost so much money. I'm so embarrassed. Again, all that I causes a lot of suffering. If there's the motivation is guided by mindfulness and wisdom, it's a response to a need. Say that Ukiah really needs a good university. The world needs Buddhist universities. The monastery needs more space. There's so many people who want to be here. Then, okay, it needs more space, needs more facilities. Okay, let's put some effort into it. It's being guided by a response to a communal need, and it's not coming from ego. It's not coming from self-view. So the motivations guided by self-view, these are called bhava-tanha, the desire to become, or vibhava-tanha, the desire to get rid of. So the problem is that they can look really like those skillful bases of success, if you see what I mean. So the desire to become, like, well, I want the university to succeed. I want this to be a good place. It can seem like it's skillful and wholesome. Well, I want to get rid of greed, hatred, and delusion. I want to get rid of my chattering thoughts. I want to get rid of my laziness and selfishness. Yeah, I do want to, and the abbot told me that I should. So that it can seem very much like that motivation to get the good things and to get rid of the bad things is in tune with Dhamma. But unconsciously, those motivations can be guided by and taken over by self-view. So in this respect, the most helpful quality is that of wise reflection, consideration, like looking directly at the motivation. What's driving this? Do I want this project to succeed because it'll make me look good? Because it's something that I need to feel affirmed by it working? Do I need to impress people? Is it because my parents are harassing me to do something useful with my life? You know, it's just to get my parents to get off my back. I want this to succeed so that they'll leave me alone. Yeah. What's the motivation? So that quality of wise reflection, you know, yoniso manasikara, that bringing the attention to look directly at motivation, see what's driving this, what's behind this. That's the most trustworthy quality. Or again, going to your friends and saying, well, I'm really interested in this, but I don't know if this is just an ego trip or this is something that is really going to be useful to people. What do you think? And again, it can be, if we're unclear about our own motivation, if it's not something that's obvious or distinct for us, then our friends can be the most reliable source of guidance and information. And so that it can be difficult to tell, but that's say one of the things as the abbot of a monastery, you know, that I find I reflect on a lot. in setting out goals for like a building project, or in terms of running retreats or training people or choosing teachings to give? How much is motivated by what's a skillful response to the situation, and what's motivated by me wanting to be someone special, or me wanting to succeed, or me wanting to not fail and to look bad? What's the guiding force behind it? And that is say really valuable to look at, to notice. And when anything is being driven by self-view, by that I, me, mine, then the encouragement is let go. Yeah, don't be fooled by that. Just leave it alone. Maybe we're just coming up to 9 o'clock. So, is this the time to bring things to a close, or is there one more question?
Yeah.
Okay.
Hi. Thank you. So, speaking of a response to a need in our current society that is seeing increasing division and tension, I feel and sense people justifying their hatred for injustice and actions, whether it's social, political, economical, environmental, moral tensions, they're justifying their hatred for those things that are injustice because they're unjust or they're immoral. And I'm finding it harder to relate and communicate with people in a way that helps them detach from that ignorance that they are clinging to. Because I believe that if you hate, then you are proliferating the cycle of hate. But it's really hard to talk to people in a conscious manner about standing up for what you believe in with love in your heart rather than hating that back. And I guess what I'm asking for is a one-line sentence to help people let go of that and recognize that ultimately hate comes from suffering of some source, and if we hate, then we're just attaching ourselves to that cycle. So how can we help others detach from it?
Good question. I'm not very good at short answers, as you might have noticed. But it's a very good question. It's a very good question because I'm British by birth. I have American citizenship as well. So I'm American by adoption. And so coming to this country, and also being a student of Ajahn Sumedho, who's American, he's very adept, very skilled at describing certain aspects of American attitude, conditioning. And he talked about it a lot, and then when I first came here, I saw it for myself, that righteous indignation is seen as a sort of a virtue. And then living here, you come across statements by people saying that if you're not angry, you're not paying attention. And that being like a sort of a statement of sort of an obvious truth that, you know, if you were paying attention, you would be angry, and that anger would be a good thing. So your question is very, very appropriate. But it also, I think you kind of answered it yourself to some degree. But rather than choosing a thing to say, it's more the way you are in yourself. So if you are, say, not manifesting that kind of angry and hateful quality, that carries its own message. And so if someone is speaking to you, or they are acting on that kind of hatred, or being angry with the evil forces, wanting to destroy the evil forces, the more that we can be fully at ease in ourselves as we speak to them, and fully attuned to them, to that moment, then the words that come will be the most helpful words. I was talking with some of the Sangha members here earlier on, and they were reminding me of the last talk I gave here at City of 10,000 Buddhas, and I was quoting, I've had a few dreams where Master Xuanhua appeared, not a lot, but a few. And so I was quoting one of those last time, but there was another one that happened many years ago, and I forget the whole story of it, but the main point of it was that Master Hua appeared in this dream, and he said, "Bright, loud, and mobile is the false; subtle and indistinct is the true." Very specific statement. Bright, loud, and mobile is the false; subtle and indistinct is the true. And then it's kind of looked at me. He spoke very good English. It's funny how that happens. In a couple of dreams of Ajahn Chah I had, he spoke very good English too. I feel is a very important message, that the subtle and the truth is often subtle and indistinct. It's in the way that you are and in your attitude that it's a subtle thing, it's an indistinct thing. But if you are able to receive that other person's rage, their anger, their indignation, you receive that, you know it, and then you're not reacting to it, but you let your heart respond. Then, and trusting that the words that arise from that receptivity, they will be appropriate to that time, that place, and that particular person. Because there's no formula. You can't say, well, these will always be the right words. Because if it's to your mother, it's going to be different than it is to an 8-year-old in the corner store. It's going to be different. If it's somebody that is, say, an 80-year-old neighbor, or someone that is in the car next to you at the red light, it's going to be a completely different dynamic. But if there is that sense of receiving somebody else's feeling, their attitude, and then that subtle quality of knowing it in your own heart and not making any kind of comment about it. It's not like thinking about it, but just really receiving it. Okay, that's what this person has just created, and that's what they're bringing forth. There's a taking it in, and then just letting your words be guided by that receptivity, by that openness. And then trusting that the appropriate words for that person, whether it's an 8-year-old or an 80-year-old, or it's your mother or your child, whoever, that will be that fits the time, the place, the situation. Because what's the right thing to say one moment, 3 seconds later, it's totally wrong. and anything that's pre-prepared, like when I speak to Joe next door, I'm going to say, guaranteed it'll be more suffering. So it's not a matter of scripting. The kind of things that are loud and obvious and clear, they're almost always going to be wide of the mark. And it's that sort of subtle attunement to the time, the place, the situation, and responding from that attunement. That's what's going to be most helpful. That's my experience, anyway. So the last thing of this evening will be the dedication of merit. So we'll do the Pali or English?
Up to you.
Okay. So this is a sharing of the blessings. So if you could just sort of wait for a moment before you disappear. We'll just, it's only a 3-minute chant, not a whole kind of half hour event. So this is a, we'll do the English version of the sharing of verses and aspiration. Now let us chant the verses of sharing and aspiration. Through the goodness that arises from my practice, may my spiritual teachers and guides of great virtue, my mother, my father, and my relatives, the sun and the moon, and all virtuous leaders of the world, may the highest gods and evil forces, celestial beings, guardian spirits of the earth, and the Lord of death, may those who are friendly, indifferent, or hostile, may all beings receive the blessings of my life. May they soon attain the threefold bliss and realize the deathless. Through the goodness that arises from my practice and through this act of sharing, may all desires and attachments quickly cease, and all harmful states of mind, until I realize Nibbana in every kind of birth. May I have an upright mind with mindfulness and wisdom, austerity and vigor. May the forces of delusion not take hold, nor weaken my resolve. The Buddha is my excellent refuge. Unsurpassed is the protection of the Dhamma. The solitary Buddha is my noble guide. The Sangha is my supreme support. Through the supreme power of all these, may darkness and delusion be dispelled. Go well. Amitabha.
We are very grateful to the Venerable Ajahn Amaro for his for this wonderful Dhamma talk. And this evening we have learned a lot from him, such as his wisdom, loving kind compassion, humor, spirit, etc. And we should apply these wholesome principles in our daily lives to improve ourselves and to help others. It's the best way to repay his kindness. Let us bow to him 3 times respectfully. Please stand up. Please put your palms together respectfully.